Welcome to the Plain Label Podcast, Pod Shots.
So, you got to the bar around 11 today. Where were you before that, just to cross that off?
Well, I was home. I left at 9:30, got a cup of coffee, newspaper, I went to Sawyer Beach and read the news.
Did you visit with anyone there?
Well, I mean, I kind of go to Sawyer Beach for the solitude.
So, your wife has no friends here. Is she kind of standoffish? Ivy League, rubs people the wrong way.
She's from New York. She's complicated. She's got very high standards.
Type A? Well, that can make you crazy if you're not like that. You seem pretty laid back. Type B. Speaking of which, Amy's blood type.
God, I don't know. I have to look it up at the house.
You don't know if she has friends. You don't know what she does all day. And you don't know your wife's blood type.
Sure, y'all are married.
I maybe it's type O.
Where are her folks? New York?
Yeah.
Can they get here in time for this press conference tomorrow?
Tomorrow? I have no idea. I haven't talked to them.
You haven't called your wife's parents
yet? I mean, you can't get a signal in this building. I've been in here talking to you.
Well, call them, please, Nick. Now.
Fine. Should I know my wife's blood type?
Hello and welcome to another episode of Pod Shots. I am your host, Eric Williams. For this episode, we are discussing the 2014 film Gone Girl. The film was written by Gillian Flynn, directed by David Fincher, and stars Ben Affleck and Rosamund Pike. Here to discuss the film with me is returning guest, Mr. Sean Stangland.
Hello, everyone.
Before getting into our discussion, I would like to mention that this podcast is brought to you by the Deliberate Noise Network. Head over to DeliberateNoise.com and check out some of the other shows that are over there. And I should also mention that Audible is offering our listeners a free audiobook of your choice and a free 30-day trial membership. Just go to audibletrial.com/plainlabelpodcast and choose from over 180,000 audio programs, download a title for free, and start listening. It's that easy. Go to audibletrial.com/plainlabelpodcast. And get started today. And we could probably recommend Gone Girl by Gillian Flynn.
Hey, what do you know?
There you go. All right, so let's do a little drink roll call, Sean. What do you have beverage-wise?
I am drinking an Alpha King Pale Ale from Three Floyds, which is a much-vaunted brewery in Munster, Indiana. This is the kind of beer, basically, the big superstores in the Chicago area, the big liquor superstores are called Binnie's, and they get Three Floyds every Thursday. And the first thing to go is Zombie Dust, which is basically the top rated IPA in the country. But you know, when that's gone, you can still get some Alpha King, which is really good too. And I it's very rare that I am around on a Thursday to get a Three Floyds, but I was off today and I thought, hey, let's get some Three Floyds.
Oh, our mutual friend, Mr. Seabrass, and I talked a little bit about Zombie Dust.
And, oh, it's so good.
And getting it on the DL sometimes if you're lucky.
Yes. The one craft beer bar around here won't always put it on the menu. Mm-hmm. You have to be in the know.
Mm-hmm. It's like a little speakeasy kind of action. So speaking of Mr. Seabrass, what I had earlier today from the New Glarus Brewing Company, which he was so kind to bring me when he visited, from Wisconsin, I had a little Spotted Cow.
There you go.
Then I moved on to some wine, and I'm not sure what that was, so I'm not going to really mention that, I guess. And then now I guess I have this concoction. It's mostly vodka, but it does have a little Red Bull, and I guess it has raspberry tea in it, because for the listeners who can't tell, I'm a little under the weather.
So well,
I figure beer, wine, and then now vodka is definitely what's going to cure my ails.
Well, clearly, it's a nice little sweet little nightcap for you there.
That's right. It is sweet. I'm going to be definitely all charged up. There you go. All right. So with that, let's begin our discussion on the 2014 film Gone Girl.
As you all know, my wife, Amy Elliott Dunn, disappeared 3 days ago.
She may be the face I can't forget, a trace of pleasure or regret. May be my treasure or the price I have to pay. She may be the song that summer sings, may be the chill that autumn brings, may be 100 different things within a measure of a day.
You can't go on like this.
Well, it's not good enough for you?
It's not even close.
She may be the reason I survive. The why and wherefore I'm alive. The one I'll care for through the rough and rainy years. Me, I'll take her laughter and her tears. And make them all my souvenirs. Where she goes, I've got to be. The meaning of my life is she. She.
Stay back, everybody, stay back.
I did not kill my wife. I am not a murderer.
And the IMDb plot synopsis goes like this. On the occasion of his fifth wedding anniversary, Nick Dunn reports that his wife, Amy, has gone missing. Under pressure from the police and a growing media frenzy, Nick's portrait of a blissful union begins to crumble. Soon, his lies, deceits, and strange behavior has everyone asking the same dark question. Did Nick Dunn kill his wife? All right, so... Stangland, this mm-hmm. was a film that I, like most films recently that we've been discussing, was a movie that I saw you talking about on Twitter and said, hey, let's talk about that one. All right. You know, and that was kind of the beginning and end of the conversation. So tell me about your history with David Fincher's Gone Girl.
Well, I knew nothing of the book, which was written by the screenwriter
yes.
as well.
Yes, yes.
All I knew was that it's the new David Fincher movie, and that's pretty much enough for me. You know, Benjamin Button and Panic Room be damned.
I like Panic Room.
I don't. But David Fincher has had me in his grip for a long time, because going back to when I was like 12 years old and watching the MTV Video Music Awards, you would notice that every video up for Video of the Year was directed by David Fincher. Mm-hmm. So, like, this guy must be the goods. And then he makes Alien 3, which I liked more than most people, including David Fincher.
I didn't.
And then 7 is, like, a damn masterpiece. So,
well, yeah, I just... He was the darling of the young, hip moviegoer, right, with 7 and Fight Club.
Yeah, absolutely. He was like, you know, Fincher for a new age, or Fincher for a new age. He is Fincher. he was like the Kubrick for a new age. And yeah. I think that's still probably the best analog for him.
No. What about Mr. Nolan?
You think Nolan is a good analog for Kubrick?
I would say Nolan is the closest to. I don't know that Fincher, I think, is too down and dirty to be a Kubrick.
Hmm.
I feel like Kubrick is more grandiose.
I suppose that's true. Yeah, Gone Girl, I suppose it's not grandiose in the way of its look. It's grandiose in its running time, obviously, but isn't that most of Fincher's movies?
Yes.
But I don't know. I saw this movie opening weekend, and I loved it, but I didn't think it was like the greatest thing ever. But then... when it came out on Blu-ray and cable, I just kept watching it. And I watch it if I'm home and Gone Girl is on, I'm watching it. And I've seen this thing like 10, 15 times now.
Mm.
And it has been elevated to, I think it's the best movie from 2014 now. And I, at the time, I was like, oh, it's Whiplash. It's got to be Whiplash, which I, you know, reacted to at a purely visceral level. But subsequent viewings of Whiplash have shown that film's failings, which are not major. It's a great film. But Gone Girl, much like Fincher's Zodiac, I just keep wanting to watch it. It's like a mystery box I want to solve, even though there might not be anything to solve. It might be all there, but I just keep watching it, trying to find new layers.
Mm. A little bit like Lost, maybe.
Oh, perhaps.
You know, that,
is this
that...
the...
I mean, that might be your thing, right?
Maybe it is. Is this the first thing we've discussed that is not science fiction? I think it is.
Wow, maybe.
Because we did the Fountain. Did we do The Fountain?
Yeah.
And Cloud Atlas and Sunshine and Lost and
Jupiter Ascending.
And Artificial Intelligence.
Yeah.
I think this is it.
That's right, because you're my go-to science fiction guy.
There you go.
What the hell are you doing on this episode?
I don't know.
Well, I guess I would have to say my history is quite the opposite of yours. When this film came out, I was like, oh, that looks interesting. I want to know nothing about it. And that was kind of my strategy. Mm-hmm. Because that was one of those where I was like, okay, it's Fincher. I'm a little unsure about the Affleck, but we'll see. But I knew I was going to watch it. And I knew it was intriguing enough from that very striking trailer with the music playing the whole time.
Kind of like the trailer that was kind of like the next week on Mad Men trailers. Where it was like just this all kind of disconnected dialogue, but you knew it was interesting.
Yeah. And what I like about that is, you know, I think that whether he has a personal hand in it or not, I think that Fincher trailers are tremendous.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know if he is involved.
Because I kind of remember the Girl with the Dragon Tattoo trailer.
Oh, it's a great one.
And I was like, holy shit. You know, the feel-bad movie of the year and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And this is actually the second Fincher movie that's ever been discussed on this episode, on this show. We did The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, and that's been it. Which is surprising to me. And it's almost one of those where it's like Seven and Fight Club are so well-known and have been so heavily discussed. What more is there to say?
Well, yeah. Have you seen Fight Club lately?
Not recently, no.
No, I've tried. I feel like it doesn't hold up. Like, I can't even get through it all the way. And at the time, I was like, this is the best movie ever.
Yeah. I wonder if it's does it have anything to do with the reveal, or is it just the stylistic choices or, like, the
I don't know dialogue? If it's the reveal, or maybe if it's too tied into, like, how I felt around 9/11.
Huh.
You know,
sure.
And like it's a movie about, you know, terrorists basically that you kind of laugh at and enjoy being with. But I don't have the same feelings about V for Vendetta, which is basically, you know, a recruiting poster for terrorism. Mm-hmm. And I love that movie. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Interesting.
But that's a tangent.
Sure. Well, that's what we do.
Yes, it is.
That's what you and I do. So I avoided all of the subsequent trailers. I didn't get a chance to see the movie, and then I just kind of lost track of it, you know, and got busy and did other shows and never got around to it. And so once I saw you talking about it, I was like, okay, well, let's do that, because it's on my queue. It's on the HBO Go. You know, I've got it tracked down all the different ways. I just need an excuse to make a point to see it.
So was last night the first time you ever watched it?
Yeah, first watch last night.
Oh, shit. Yeah.
And so I told Anel, because we watched it together, and I told her that I was glad that I didn't record last night, because I was glad that I was able to sort of let it stew for a day.
Uh-huh.
You know, and think about it a little bit for the day. So, I mean, obviously you're a big fan of the film. What are some of the things that you particularly enjoy about it?
Well, number one, the dialogue, which I don't know how much of it she took directly from her book, because I haven't read the book. But and I don't know if some of it is Fincherized or ad-libbed, or I wouldn't be surprised to learn if Aaron Sorkin, who wrote The Social Network, came in and did a script doctor job on this. I would like to think that this is all hers. I haven't read the book to know. The dialogue is just so amazing to me in this movie. And I mean, that's the thing that stands out, but it's just
Before you get away from that, so amazingly, amazing how? Like, is it amazing in that you think that it's really naturalistic, or it's like surprising or sophisticated, or what is it about it that really strikes you, I guess?
I kind of think it's all of that. There's some dialogue that feels so dead on to me, like. Like when Ben Affleck, he's talking to the detectives, and it's right after that scene. He's talking to his sister, played by Carrie Coon, and he says, "A year ago, Amy being pregnant would have been the best thing ever." And that just seems like such a real desperate thing that someone in our time would say, like the phrasing of that.
Some hyperbolic thing that people would say now.
Exactly. And like that kind of over the top reaction that people have now. And then you have Tyler Perry.
Who, God, he was every good. Word, he was yes, good.
He's fantastic. And like every line he has is just like, it's perfection. It's heightened, mm-hmm. but it's perfect.
You know, and then. Let me interrupt you again. Sorry.
Mm-hmm. No, that's fine.
my job is just to derail Sean in this episode.
Yes, basically.
But I thought that's what a good director does. Is that everything is so well measured by the actors, and a lot of it, sure, you can come into a role saying, well, I want to play it like this, I want to do it like this, but it is the director's job to guide the actor and say, like, okay, well, maybe take it up a little here, or maybe tone that down a little bit, mm-hmm. and to know what is going to fit overall, and to make sure that character is consistent, because you know, the majority of the films are not shot chronologically. So
right.
to make sure mm-hmm. that it all fits within, you know, the piece. And Tyler Perry, I thought was great. And I thought, I mean, this is one of my favorite Ben Affleck roles just because he didn't feel like Ben Affleck to me. And in that, he just felt like a guy, you know, and I can see obviously that it's Ben Affleck and he has his little Ben Affleck smirk that they take advantage of, you know, when she's even saying, basically she's saying, give me that shitty little grin.
Right.
You mm-hmm. know, and you know, we can talk about Rosamund Pike, in a more extended period here in a bit, but yes. So I thought that was really well done. Not only the dialogue, but the choices that the actor and the directors made.
Mm-hmm. Well, and another thing about the movie, and I think one of the things that keeps bringing me back to it, it seems like it's alternately completely on the nose and then also all under the surface at the same time. Like you have these – the movie starts with these completely obvious signifiers. Like he goes to the bar and he's got the board game Mastermind under his arm. So it's like they're telling the audience, hey, maybe he's the mastermind of this whole plot.
Yep.
Margo puts it with all these other board games. There's like, let's make a deal and sorry. Life. Yes. And again, they play the game of life and Margo's wearing a shirt that says protect your nuts. Like all these big obvious signifiers and there's stuff. To me, the movie is mostly about the roles that people play to please other people. And they say stuff about that explicitly throughout the movie. So it's like they're hammering it into your head. But I also feel like there's so much going on under the surface, too. It's like a movie that's operating on at least two different levels.
Yeah, and what I think
That's why I find multiple viewings really reward you.
Yeah, I can see that because I think what is really fun about it is, you know, unless you don't know a single thing about the film, you saw from the plot synopsis, the main crux of the movie is, did he do this or did he not?
Right.
And so I don't know how the movie's going to go. I hadn't read the book either. So I'm thinking, okay, well, we're going to go through this entire film. And we had paused it once, you know, to get a drink or whatever. And I was like, holy shit, we got a long ways to go. And I was like, wow, you know, they're really going to stretch this out if he did it or not. But then they don't.
Yeah, the whole movie turns upside down halfway through.
Yeah, and I'm like, wait, what? And then it becomes something much more than what I thought it was. Mm-hmm. And then I was completely, you know, strapped in and with the rest of the movie for sure.
Oh, I don't know what to say. You've left me speechless.
That's fine. So let's talk a little bit. I talked about, you know, Ben Affleck. Let's talk about his counterpart, Rosamund Pike.
Amazing.
She is... I have very limited experience with her. I know her from An Education,
where she
played the very attractive yet very stupid wife of one of the characters.
Yeah.
And she has tremendous lines in that movie. And I was like, wow, she's very good. Like, you know, you have to be very good to be honestly that dumb in a performance. Yeah. It's not like the girls in Mean Girls or something, you know. And so here, She's got this very airy sort of fairy tale voice. And I was like, oh boy, I don't know. I don't know if this is going to work. I don't know what I think of this. And once, you know, the whole reveal happens and once we get out of the sort of Amazing Amy stuff and into more of the present day and what's going on, and I was completely blown away and just was amazed at how quickly and how easily she just fits into the sort of evildoer type role.
Yeah.
And just looks the part and acts the part. And I was very, very impressed. And it's no surprise that she was nominated for an Oscar.
In a movie where everyone is playing roles in which they are playing roles, she's like playing multiple roles upon roles. Cause it's like the diary entries are clearly in a different voice from Amy's real voice.
Mm-hmm.
So then it's like the stuff that you're watching during those diary entries in the first half of the movie, you have to wonder how much of that are we supposed to think is really what happened and how much of it is what Amy is fabricating for the diary. Mm-hmm. And then you have the cool girl speech, which is when the real Amy comes out. and then you have Amy playing the part of Nancy when she's hiding out in that cabin with her redneck neighbors. And then you have the version of Amy that she's putting up for Desi Collins, who played by Neil Patrick Harris.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's just.
And then we have the maybe real, maybe not sort of very end.
Yes. I mean, you are asking so much of her in this movie, and she just fucking knocks it out of the park.
Yeah. Yeah, she really does.
It's an amazing performance, and I wish it would yield better things for her, because so far after this, all I see her advertised in is like straight to voodoo stuff, you know, straight to video on demand stuff.
Yeah, I don't get it. I don't know if she needs a new agent or what.
Yeah, I don't know. Or if this one part is just so singular that everybody's like, well, we don't know what else to cast you in.
Yeah, well, maybe it could be like, I forget the woman's name, but she was in Compliance, and then she didn't really do much and was really lobbying for an Oscar nomination and didn't get one.
Ann Dowd,
and now
yeah, she's on The Leftovers, yeah.
And so she's finally found her niche now, but but yeah, I mean, Rosamund, I mean, she was absolutely wonderful. And I just love the idea of unreliable narrators.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like that while I am a kind of a sucker for them, because I think it's kind of a bullshit way to tell a story, but I also think it's a really ballsy way to tell a story.
Yes. When it's done well, it's fantastic.
Mm-hmm. And you have to straddle that line between being a real hack and really knowing what you're doing.
Yeah. And like in a way, this movie kind of reminds me of Atonement in that way. How when you get to a reveal in Atonement, at first you feel kind of cheated, but then you go back over it and you're like, and it changes the entire story for you. Mm-hmm. Which is another one where I haven't read the book, but I've seen the movie a ton of times.
You know, I really like that movie.
Oh, it's fantastic.
I can't get over the sound in that movie.
The sound?
Yeah, just the sound in general.
Hmm.
And I think it's the typewriter that really sticks in my mind.
Oh, see, I love the score where they put the typewriter in the score. That's great stuff.
So yeah, so she's tremendous. Do you have any problems with the movie? Because I do have an issue.
The one issue, I watched it again this morning, and the one issue I really have with it is that I feel like the character of Nick's dad exists only to provide that second house.
To get him to go over there.
Yes, they don't develop that enough. He's only in the one scene, really. His dad, he picks him up at the police station and takes him back to his nursing home. But I feel like that's a very undeveloped thing. The rest of it, like, you know, there are plot holes the size of the Grand Canyon in this movie, but I don't think that really matters, because it's really not a movie about the machinations of the plot. It's a movie about about who these people are and who we are watching it, really.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really care so much about the plot holes because I don't care at all about them, quite honestly, because it's not – that's not what this movie's about to me.
Sure.
It's not about an airtight plot.
I would think that – or I would say that the only part that – I guess let me put it this way. The only part that I didn't particularly enjoy as much – the weaknesses that I would say is I didn't really like the whole twist of the finding the money from the redneck neighbor. Like the sort of white trash lady.
Yes, that is kind of weak, isn't it?
And I'm like, she does her little kick again and drops the money. And then it's like, all of a sudden it's something out of like Wild Things or something. Southern, sultry, sweaty film.
Yeah.
And I'm like, what is this?
I thought about that earlier today when she, you know, she makes like the hole in one or whatever at mini golf, which seems like an activity that Amy Dunn would never participate in.
Mm-hmm.
And she gives that little yelp with that kick. It's like, do you think that she's doing that because she thinks she should do it for them?
She's putting on a show, sure.
Okay. The reveal of the money, I mean, I get why they do that because it gives her more impetus to want to come home. But yes, you're right. That is kind of weak sauce there, isn't it?
I would say that I don't know that we have the Amy character have an actual genuine moment in the movie.
Well, yeah, that's true, isn't it?
Everything is for something. Everything's some sort of show. And, you know, I was talking to Anel because we had both talked about how that was the part where we were just kind of like, this doesn't seem like it's the same movie or this doesn't seem to fit with the rest of it. Excuse me. And so we kind of came out that part as not being our favorite. But then we did agree, well, she has to go to Neil Patrick Harris for some reason.
Yeah.
She has to go there. She has to be down on her luck.
Somehow. Well, I guess, yeah, our separate complaints kind of boil down to the same thing, don't they? It's two things that kind of just seem there to move the plot along, and I wonder if those two things are better developed in the book.
I would hope so. I would hope so. Let's talk a little bit about, isn't it Desi?
Desi Collins, yeah.
What a weird choice. That's such an odd character and an odd choice of casting because I thought Neil Patrick Harris was fine and I enjoy him as an actor. And I thought he was really funny on How I Met Your Mother. And I used to watch that show quite a bit, and he's a very openly gay man. And I have zero problems with that, but right. I do think it is interesting to have him in this role as kind of a weirdo stalker. And then like he's obsessed with Amy and he's in kind of a sexual role. And I just thought that was a strange choice for him.
I do kind of wonder if casting him was a very cynical act in saying, well, okay, middle America is going to see Neil Patrick Harris, America's favorite gay man, in this part and inherently think that he's creepy for taking a part where he's not America's favorite gay man. Like, and that seems like such a cynical thing to say, but I wonder if that's why he got the part.
Sure. Yeah,
kind of like the if we're gonna cast him totally against type just to subvert the expectations of the people who live in the places where this movie is taking place, you know, middle America, because this is like I wouldn't call it rural Missouri.
It seems like exurban
Missouri, maybe.
Yeah, it's somewhere just out of St. Louis because they show the arches.
It doesn't feel like a suburb though. It feels like, you know, like we I don't know if you have the term exurban out there, but like, you know, where it's just past the suburbs, but not quite in the country, you know.
Well, it's close enough to where they have a fancy house.
Well, yeah, that's for sure.
They have a little community there.
Yes, they do.
But yeah, I don't know. I mean, the way that they spoke, though, that is definitely Missouri.
Okay.
Because I remember going to, I've been, you know, I have family that live in Missouri. And the way that Kim Dickens was talking as the detective, I mean, she was exactly on.
She was Missouri as fuck.
Yeah, she was just Missouri, you know.
Who, and, by the way, is also great in this.
Yeah, she is. She's really
She's
good.
She's always great.
It was really nice to see her in more of a leading role.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, because she just kind of always seems to get the shaft.
Well, yeah, like, the first time I remember seeing her was in Hollow Man, where she's just like, she's just there so that invisible Kevin Bacon can grope her tits. Mm-hmm. I'm like, ugh.
I think
that was so distasteful to me.
Well, I mean, obviously she was in Lost, but
yes.
I remember her in Deadwood and in Friday Night Lights as well.
Which I never watched either of those.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And I'm not watching her current show, Fear the Walking Dead.
No, I'm not watching that either.
No.
I don't have time to watch the... I didn't have enough interest to watch the original. I'll say it that way.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so what else about this movie? I mean, there's lots of ways to go. What else? What do you think the role of Mr. Fincher played in this movie?
Well...
I mean, here's
that's a tough question, because it seems like this is all in the script.
Sure.
So, you said, it's all about managing performances, but I mean, it certainly feels like a David Fincher movie.
Well, yes, and it's a thing where it's just I'm so frustrated by the J.J. Abrams, Steven Spielberg, lens flare, stuff. I'm equally as frustrated by the, oh, it's David Fincher, so it's dark.
Right.
Yeah, that it is.
It is.
So and, what?
And you know what? I was thinking it looks like real life. Like, yeah. I don't know if they tried to shoot this with as much natural light as possible, but it sure looks like it.
Mm-hmm.
Like the scene, especially the scene when they have the vigil. Like that looks like legit, like what that would look like.
Right,
it doesn't look like a stylized version of it at all. That's just that scene particularly struck me as this is what it actually looks like in real life.
Yeah, not every row of people was individually lit.
Yeah, exactly.
There wasn't a spotlight on the girlfriend until she spoke. You know, there's all of those, all of those things were as they would really be.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, it certainly kind of continues the streak of some people would call it misanthropic movies by Fincher. I don't know if he hates these people as much as he just observes how people really are. I mean, yeah, we're all putting on some kind of a part when we deal with people. So. I feel like that's really the overarching theme of the whole movie.
It's the
role that we play.
It's just the faces we put forth, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And he's really kind of refined his identity with the Jeff Cronenweth, the director of photography, and then with Reznor and Ross doing the music, which is just like, you know. That music will never work. You couldn't listen to that music in your car.
No.
But when you put it with a David Fincher movie, it works perfectly. And I don't think that's going to be like a relationship like Spielberg and John Williams. I don't like those guys are going to do every Fincher movie from now on, I would imagine. Unless he ever makes that 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, and then he'll need a big orchestral Michael Giacchino score. But there we go. I managed to reference Michael Giacchino. There we go.
That is nice. I'm sitting here skimming through some of the notes about the movie. So it says about Rosamund Pike, said for her performance, she drew inspiration from Nicole Kidman in To Die For and Sharon Stone in Basic Instinct. She also studied Caroline Kennedy, wife of JFK, for her body language and aloof mood.
I had read a review by Matt Zoller Seitz, who is the guy who runs RogerEbert.com now, where he compared this movie to like Basic Instinct and Fatal Attraction. Maybe I haven't seen those movies in a long time, but I think this movie is far above the class of those movies.
Well, yeah, because those movies are about You know, it's kind of like the difference between a horror and a thriller. Like, what is the objective of the film? Is the objective there? Is it to horrify and gross you out? Because then it's a horror film.
Right.
Is that the goal, or is it about more than that? So Basic Instinct, is it about, oh, we're going to have this murder mystery and it's going to be this kinky sex and it's going to be this ice pick? Or is it about, you know, is it about society and the faces that we show to each other?
Yeah, that's it, isn't it? That is the difference.
That is the difference. God damn it.
God damn it.
But no, but I do like that she, you know, apparently pulled from different performances and studied and that sort of thing. There was a bunch of people that were considered for the role, and I'm glad that she landed as opposed to Reese Witherspoon.
I remember that. I think, wasn't Reese Witherspoon like attached to direct this at some point or something?
Well, she bought the rights for the film.
Okay.
And she is one of the producers and basically helped get it made.
I can't imagine Reese Witherspoon in this movie.
No.
It wouldn't work.
Did you know that this is Carrie Coon's feature film debut?
I didn't know that, and I'm glad you brought her up, because that is another one of the most interesting things about this movie, is the portrayal of a brother-sister an adult brother-sister relationship that I don't think I've ever seen one like this in a movie. And, you know, in that first scene, like, who did you think she was in that first scene?
I thought it was an ex-girlfriend or something. I had no idea.
Yes, or perhaps even knowing basically what the movie's about, like thinking that maybe that's who he's killing Amy to be with her.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very, we get more than halfway through the movie until someone says in that airport where he's in the airport and he overhears someone say twincest.
Yeah.
That's over halfway through the movie, but the whole audience has been thinking that the entire time, since the word go. Oh, which happens to be your name. But anyway, like, it's so strange, but I mean, a lot of it I think feels true. I have a pretty close relationship with my two sisters. We're all in the 32 to 36 range, which is roughly where these two characters are.
Mm-hmm.
But nothing like – I don't think we ever have conversations where people would think that we were, you know, fucking. Mm-hmm. So I really think that's interesting, and I'm probably the only person on Earth who has this theory. It's not really a theory, more than just something – a crazy idea that I had one time watching this. The very last shot of the film – it almost looks like Rosamund Pike's face is digitally combined with Carrie Coon's face. And I don't know what point there would be to do that. I don't know what that says about the characters or the movie. And there's no way, and no one has ever even said that, but it's just something I noticed. And it's just one more little strange wrinkle to the relationship in this movie.
That's really interesting.
I mean, there's no way it's legit, because Rosamund Pike, she looks so different from scene to scene in this movie. You know, they quote unquote fatten her up in the middle section and they frump her up. She's the frumpy Amy Dunn is still like the most fabulously attractive woman on the planet.
Right. Yeah, she's up to like 125 and she's all frumpy, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, going to big lots, which that's another thing that – the product placement in this movie is interesting too, because it feels like it's there for a reason. Like all these, you know, there's this one thing where they show like a Walmart marquee and a KFC marquee, like right in a row, like, you know, call Amazing Amy. It's just kind of like, it feels like they did the same thing, like Young Adult, Jason Reitman's Young Adult, where it was like, they made a point of showing all these stores and all these product names, because it's like, this is what envelops us 24/7.
Yeah, it's almost it's not like a pride to let me buy advertising on your movie. It's more like reflecting who we are and making fun of those businesses instead.
Exactly. And I like, you know, she's hanging out, Amy's hanging out with her next door neighbor who's drinking Mountain Dew.
Mm-hmm.
And she's like, fuck, that's good. And I love how Amy, this criminal mastermind, Amy still takes the time to spit in somebody's drink. Like, mm-hmm. she's still that petty that she will spit in that drink.
Mm-hmm. let's talk a little bit about the ending. We haven't really got into it too much. So we have this prompt where it's did he or didn't he, and obviously he did not kill her, even though, you know, depending on which story you believe, he had plenty of, reason to, I guess. I mean, if killing someone is a reasonable thing, but he had reason to leave her for sure.
Well, yes, he had, what does she call her? The girl with the come on me tits to go to.
Right. Andy was her
yes,
name.
Yes. Emily Ratajkowski, mm-hmm. supermodel Emily Ratajkowski.
Right. So she'd orchestrated this whole plan, and she was going to kill herself and all this stuff. That's quite a plan to take it to that degree to where you're mm-hmm. going to kill yourself. But then I did like how it was a sticky note and she kept adjusting, you know, and kept moving it around. And I was like, oh, okay, well, you're not as quite as, committed as maybe, you know, I thought you were, and maybe you're a little crazier than I thought you were.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And I love the fact that, Tanner Bold, Tyler Perry's character, and Ben Affleck start to play with her a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, look, she's out there. Just say the things you're supposed to say. Say these certain things, all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So the real controversy, I feel like, is the very, very end. And it is, you know, Amy comes back. She's there for the media to see after she's killed Desi in a horrifically bloody scene.
Oh, there were gasps in the theater. It was amazing.
Yeah, an element. Oh my God. Mm-hmm. Like that. You know, once all of the blood started gushing, but, you know, she poses so all the pictures can take, all the cameramen can take pictures of her, and everything's all hunky dory, and they reveal that she's pregnant, and, Ben Affleck is told that it's his, and he tells Margot, or Go, as he calls her, he tells her that he's going to stay with her.
Mm-hmm.
And that as crazy as she is, he's not going to allow their child to become like her.
Mm-hmm.
And he chooses to stay with her. What do you think of that ending?
I hadn't really arrived at peace with the ending until today.
Mm.
Because the ending does seem so beyond the pale. Like why is, like, it's just got a sheer fear that he's staying there.
Mm-hmm.
But then even from the other, I was more hung up on what is her motivation? Like, why did she even want to kill herself in the first place? And what makes her not want to?
Mm-hmm.
And maybe this is obvious to some people, but it finally clicked today that she wanted to kill herself because it was something that Amazing Amy couldn't do. Cause it's all set up that the Amazing Amy books that her parents wrote about her, like, they always made Amazing Amy better.
Mm.
Amazing Amy was more fantastic than the real Amy. She was always one step ahead. Well, this would, like, the killing herself would be the ultimate act. Like, Amazing Amy can't kill herself before I do, you know, because the series, I'm assuming they were still writing books. Or, you know, Amazing Amy would never do something this outlandish or this cold-blooded. Mm-hmm. So it was like, this is how I can finally trump Amazing Amy. But then when Ben Affleck decides that he's going to, you know, when he appears on the show as Cecil Ward and touches his chin to show that he's not lying,
mm-hmm.
to me it's like now she's like, I can control somebody the way that my parents tried to control me. So it's like she can take back that control, and like it's like Ben Affleck is her Amazing Amy.
Interesting.
And so
From Nick Dunn's point of view, I think it's just pure fear. And he can justify it all he wants by saying he doesn't want the kid to grow up like her. But I think it's more that he's just afraid of her. But he doesn't want to admit that to Margot because he doesn't want Margot, his opinion, Margot's opinion of him has already come way down.
Yes.
He doesn't want it to go any further. So I think it's all fear on his side. But on her side, she's like, I've got him. I've got him, and I can make someone in my own image the way that my parents made Amazing Amy in my image.
That's really interesting. I guess here, I need to watch this again because I think I've had a real, I wouldn't say misreading, but I think that I missed something. I guess I thought that Amy was the one writing the Amy stories.
No, it's her parents that write the Amy
because
story.
I thought that she had said that the parents wrote a biography about her, but that she was the one who wrote the Amy stories.
No, her parents write the Amazing Amy stories, and she's like a magazine writer.
Okay.
And she's like, Amazing Amy was always one step ahead of me.
Yeah, I knew that she had referenced, you know, the volleyball team and all of that kind of thing, and I guess I just thought that she was the author. And I guess overall, I was kind of like, when you were saying that, I was like, well, I guess it doesn't make a big difference, but then it does make a difference because she's not able to control anything, but then she knows how to control men.
Yes.
Right. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things I wanted to get to was how few men there are in this movie. Because there is Ben Affleck, Desi, Tanner Bolt, and the officer that we sort of see, and that's it.
Well, and like her dad, and then the character. I mean,
there's males in it, but they're not.
As far as like main characters.
Yeah, they're not prominently featured in comparison to a typical Hollywood film.
Yes, I'd say that's probably correct. Yeah.
Because you have Amy.
This is definitely. Yeah.
You know, you have the sister, you have the lead detective, also a woman, you have the best friend, you have the girlfriend. You have the Cella Ward.
And then the Nancy Grace, played by Missy Pyle.
Oh, right.
Who's great.
Yeah, she's tremendously trashy in this. You know, she's so good. She's very good at that. So all of those, I mean, you have basically three main male guys and probably four to five female roles.
Mm.
And that's if you include Neil Patrick Harris, but that's just not typical. And I was like, okay, well, this is definitely for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
This is, you know, not a common Fincher thing that he just does or something.
Right.
And I was just really taken by that. I was like, I wonder if, you know, if that means anything or if I'm just reading into something or what. But I think that you're, now that I realized the mistake that I had made about who was writing the books, I think that that's completely right. I think that, you know, she realizes what she can control, who she can control, and that's her fun.
Right? Yeah.
that's what she has to.
So, and here's something I never even considered until earlier today when someone asked me this question on Twitter, and it never even occurred to me. At the end of this movie, do you think that she's going to kill Nick?
Yeah. Well, and here's the question that Anel asked me. Whose baby is it? Because I feel like it's Desi's, right?
It could be Desi's. I didn't think of that either. But, yeah, of course it could be. There is something about how he gave a sample that was frozen early in the movie.
Right, that's true.
I'm kind of iffy on that part. But, yeah, it could be Desi's kid, too.
Because it seems like Desi maybe didn't get to completion before he was killed.
No, he did though, because when she goes to the hospital, the doctor tells Nick and the detective that semen was present.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
Yep. So there you go.
Oh yeah. Okay. Yes, that's right. I remember that. So yeah. So it could be either one of them, I guess. And he had talked about how he wanted a paternity test, and that.
Right.
That would bring up to where if he does call her out on that, you know, she has that sample. So.
That's right.
Hmm.
So yeah, I guess we don't know, do we? But it doesn't really matter. She's going to have the baby either way.
I think the person that I feel the worst for at the end of the movie, though, is Margot.
Yeah.
Because she loves her brother. She's going to have to deal with their drama for the rest of her life.
Yeah. And she can't say anything.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, I mean, she could, but they have this conversation with Kim Dickens and Tyler Perry at the end where it's like, well, why can't we do anything? And it's just, it does feel like kind of a totally fake conversation. Like, well, of course they could still do some things about it, but for the sake of the movie, the discussion is over. Mm-hmm. Like, Amy won. And that's fine. I don't really have a quibble with that.
Sure. Sure. Yeah, I was hoping for a little bit more out of the whole police stuff, but then I was kind of glad that they weren't so formal.
Mm-hmm.
Compared to a lot of other films where you'll see them like, oh, well, you gotta go to the slammer, pal, you know, and I know you did it, see, you know, and all that kind of stuff.
Uh-huh.
I'm glad that they didn't do that sort of thing.
No, the police, do, they never feel like an obstacle in this movie. They are as enjoyable as anything else in the movie. It's mm-hmm. very well written that way.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really well done. You know, it's one of those movies where even after, you know, finding out what happened and finding the sort of quote-unquote trick or the end, it does make me want to see what Gillian Flynn's novel is all about.
Yeah, I'm a horrible reader because I don't read. My job is reading all day, so it's like the last thing I want to do is have to sit down and pay attention and read something that like I have to really pay attention to. So I never read. So, but I do want to read this book, and I want to read more from her. Apparently, the next movie that was adapted from a thing of hers was not very good. It's Dark called Places. Dark Places. Yeah, and it
with
went
Charlize.
Yeah, and it went straight to video on demand, which is not a good. Just like Rosamund Pike's subsequent movies. So
that's so odd because Charlize Theron, Nicholas Holt, who is not a huge name, but he's in he's in the X-Men movies.
Yeah,
Christina Hendricks. Ty Sheridan, who's, you know, getting a lot of acclaim. Mm-hmm. Chloe Grace Moretz. Corey Stoll. Like, there's decent names.
Ah, Corey Stoll. That's going to make me watch that movie.
Yeah. So there's a lot of names. IMDb, but the reviews aren't terrible. But,
I don't know.
But, yeah, it apparently wasn't very good.
It's weird the number of big names now who are in all kinds of shit that you never heard of. Like if you put on your video on demand menu and you're like, what the fuck is this Morgan Freeman movie? Cause Morgan Freeman's in like 11 movies a year, but you only hear of like two of them.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
But her next film is a TV movie. So that's announced.
Oh, hopefully not for Lifetime.
I don't know. It just says Sharp Objects.
Well.
So I don't have high hopes for that.
I have seen a lot of reviews that refer to Gone Girl as like the ultimate Lifetime movie. Mm. And I kind of think that's true. It sounds like an insult, but I mean, it is. You could easily see this being an exploitive, totally trashy Lifetime movie. And Fincher and Flynn and the actors just elevated into so much more.
Yeah, I guess that's the difference between, that's what talent is, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is you can have a plot that is maybe not all that important when it comes down to it, but when you have
right.
good writing and you have good acting and good direction, it amounts to a hell of a lot more than a Lifetime movie.
Well, yeah, I mean, Girl with the Dragon Tattoo is pretty pulpy nonsense, but David Fincher made it into a hell of a movie, just like the Swedish directors did. And Social Network, on the face of it, you're like, who gives a shit about Facebook? And then it was the most critically acclaimed movie of that year. So this he kind of specializes in elevating material that at first blush doesn't seem like much.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. What's he doing next, Mr. Stangland?
That's a good question that I should know the answer to. For a long time, the answer to that question was 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, which mm-hmm. seemed like the worst fit ever. Like, why is he making that movie? And Disney finally decided against it, I'm guessing because they had a long string of flops that were geared towards that kind of same audience.
Mm-hmm.
Now they're kind of in the – they're only in the Marvel, Star Wars, and fairy tale remake business. I mean, it's hard to find a worse stretch of big budget flops than John Carter, Lone Ranger, Tron Legacy, and whatever the most recent one. Oh, Tomorrowland. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, that's the other movie we did, yeah.
Yes.
Your most anticipated.
Of this year, yeah. Well, until Star Wars. I mean, it's fucking Star Wars. But yeah, I don't know. I actually don't know what his next thing is. I think he's got another project at HBO, and I'm sure House of Cards is still going on, which I haven't watched any of that.
You know, he's not listed as doing anything. He has Video Synchronicity, which is a TV series that he's announced that he's doing the first two episodes of.
Well, there you
go. But that's all that he's been announced to do. So it's kind of, that's kind of interesting that he's, I don't know if taking a step back is the right word, but, you know, he was coming out with movies a little more frequently than he is currently.
Yeah, I don't know. I hope he makes it a more frequent clip because, like, the other contemporary of his that is often cited as the greatest filmmaker of our time, Paul Thomas Anderson, seems to be taking forever between movies, and his last two were, to my mind, huge disappointments. But if you're an LA film critic, you probably disagree with me.
What do you mean? You mean After There Will Be Blood?
Yeah. The Master and Inherent Vice. Mm. I mean, okay, The Master at least had something going on. Inherent Vice, I just didn't get that movie. I need to watch it again, but my God. Like, it seems like the kind of movie I should enjoy, and I feel like if the Coen brothers had directed it, I would have enjoyed it. But Paul Thomas Anderson's current style, which is this languid, overwrought style, it just doesn't see. It works for There Will Be Blood. It doesn't seem to work for a stoner comedy.
I need to see that. I've yet to see Inherent Vice.
Well, buckle up.
You know, one of my favorite movies when I did the movie a day thing in 2011 was Punch Drunk Love.
Yeah.
Because I had yet to see it. And I couldn't believe that I was so head over heels with this Adam Sandler movie.
An Adam Sandler movie that's directed like kind of an abstract French film, maybe?
Yeah.
And it's 90 minutes long, which is fantastic.
And what's funny about it is I really enjoy that movie and would definitely go to bat for that movie. And a lot of people that I talk to are like, oh, that's the worst Adam Sandler movie I've ever seen. And I'm like, you are an idiot.
Well, yeah, that was the thing about that movie is that if you were all gung-ho about The Waterboy and The Wedding Singer, yeah, you were not going to like that movie.
Right. It's not happening. Just not happening. All right. Well, Sean, anything else about Gone Girl before?
I just want to say that the scariest thing in this movie is when they're talking about hiring Tanner Bolt and Margot Dunn, who I would guess is about a 35-year-old, you know, she's 35 years old. She's co-owner of a bar in suburban St. Louis, says that she has $47,000 in her savings account. And I about shit my pants in the theater. Because I'm like, I'm 36 right now, and if I had $47,000 in my savings account, I'd probably be like walking around like the Joker in Batman throwing out money in Tim Burton's Batman, like, hubba, 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 money, money, money. Who do you trust?
Who do you trust?
Like, I suppose she could have gotten most of that money, like, inherited from their mother who died. But still, I remember watching this movie, and she's, I have $47,000 in savings. And I go, what?
Yeah, I
guess. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe most 35-year-olds have that much money in their savings account. What do I know?
Yeah. She should have been like, and what's Nick Dunn doing? He's at home washing his tights.
Exactly.
Yeah, I heard that too, and I was like, whoa. You and I don't live on the same world.
So. Yeah, that's like, did you see the Ben Stiller remake of Walter Mitty?
Mm-hmm.
That movie completely undercuts itself in the very first scene where he's balancing his checkbook, mm-hmm. and you see that he has over $10,000 in his checking account.
Yeah.
I'm like, I'm supposed to feel sorry for this guy?
It's ridiculous. You know, and what was so bad about it was we watched that for class, for the class, because we went and read the short story.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's all about this sad sack and you're supposed to identify with him. And, you know, we read the story. Story's over. Kids are like, Mr. Williams, he's got a lot of money. I don't feel bad for him.
Exactly.
And I just was like, anybody else have anything wrong with him? You know, I was like, I don't have anything to tell you. Like, that is a very good point. I don't know what to say. Mm-hmm. That is a mistake of the film.
And it's the very first, it's like the first shot, literally the first shot of the movie.
Yeah.
I was like, fuck this movie right off the bat.
Yeah, talk about missing the whole point.
Yeah, exactly.
Jesus Christ. All right, well, anyway, so I would say Gone Girl, really, really enjoyed it. Anel had, you know, she was like, ooh, I don't like that. She wanted to talk about relationships. She wanted to say, you know, just don't leave me for some perky tits McGee. That's what she had said. You know, it was a whole lot of discussing our relationship after this movie, which was fine, you know.
I think that's going to spur a lot. You know, I think that's what happened to a lot of people. When Lisa and I finally watched this, we didn't really have any of that. We were more talking about the film, but because we're both film people, I guess.
There you go, yeah.
And you know, we were both at that, I think we were both heavily intoxicated by the end of the movie, and probably talking about our relationship wasn't the best idea.
That's smart. That's smart food. All right, well, yeah, so I very much enjoyed this one, and, you know, I, of course, thanks to Sean for pointing out the mistakes that I made. And
hey, you only saw it once. I've seen it like 15 times.
There you go. Once and yesterday. So that's my excuse. So if you have any comments, suggestions, or movies that you'd like to hear us talk about for PodShots, you could email us at plainlabelpodcast@gmail.com. You can follow the show under the handle @plainlabelpod, where you can follow me. I'm @EricWilliams79. We also have a Facebook page for the show where you could like it. Just search for Plain Label Podcast. And if you wanted to help us out a little bit, you could head over to Amazon.com and you could search for our wish list. It's full of movies that we want, equipment that we need, and a whole host of other goodies in case you're in the giving mood. Just search for the wish list called Plain Label Podcast. So I do want to thank Mr. Stanglin once again for coming on and discussing yet another film with me. If they wanted to hear more from you or get a hold of you online, where could they do so?
They can go to @SeanStanglinDH, which is my work account, and you'll find links to my weekly column in the Daily Herald in Ellington Heights, Illinois, and musings on Chicago sports. And then if you're a super nerd, you can go to my new alternate Twitter handle, @SeanTheDizNerd, because I decided that I didn't want to have a self-fulfilling prophecy anymore and call myself angry in my Twitter handle.
That's right.
So instead of angry Disney nerd, I'm now Sean the Diz Nerd, but I still get kind of angry, but at least I'm not, calling myself that anymore.
Angry no more, I say.
That's right, angry no more.
All right, well, thank you for listening, and we'll be back in 2 weeks with another co-host and another film.